Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges.
Good afternoon. This is Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, your host of The Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. My guest today has been with us before. She's Ashley Warner, author of The Year After, a rape memoir. And Ashley, first of all, how are you this afternoon?
Oh, I'm well. Thanks, Marcello. Good to be with you again.
Good. I always appreciate, as I was saying when we were off air, I appreciate talking to you. I'm sorry only that the subject matter needs constant reminders and updates and conversation. We of course, are talking again for all those who might need some clarity. The recent Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, as we know, gave their report on the rape coverage, the University of Virginia student known as Jackie, rape coverage in Rolling Stone, and it was a scathing report of inappropriate media coverage or journalism practices in general. But I want to talk with Ashley. As we know from previous shows, Ashley Warner herself was a rape target and managed to get her rapist arrested, indicted, and jailed. And she has gone on to be a therapist for others in similar situations. And she's a great authority, putting it mildly. And I want to talk with Ashley because I feel like, as always happens, the victim, Jackie, or any of the other, hundreds of thousands of women who are abused on a daily basis, their names they're the ones who become the victim the second time around by either being forgotten or discredited or blamed for it. And Ashley, this latest thing with Rolling Stone, I think the greatest crime, if you will, is that now women who are in Jackie's position are going to not want to come forward. They're going to suffer this terrible thing in silence. What do you think about that?
Well, that certainly is the concern of anti-sexual violence advocates everywhere. And to their credit, both everybody involved with the Rolling Stone UVA case has expressed the same regret.
Yes.
I think everybody has expressed that they're very, very sorry that about any impact this would have on dissuading a survivor to come forward. It is already so tough for a survivor to come forward for many reasons. And, here's one more, the story being just sensationalized, dragged through the mud, what have you. We don't know in the end what happened to Jackie or didn't happen to Jackie, but unfortunately now the attention is turned to how accurate sexual assault survivors who report are.
Exactly.
There's always the question of how frequently are there false reports made? And then we get into a debate on whether there's a lot of false reporting or not, and it all detracts from the fact that sexual assault does occur at an alarming rate. and it, you know, detracts us from that conversation about what to do about it.
Yes. Just remind us, because you have told me before that, understandably, very often after a woman has been raped, or a man, we know that can happen too, but there is a mental confusion. There is a confluence, if you will, of the facts. And to expect people to come out of something like that and remember everything accurately, using your own experience as evidence, your information, your memories, if you will, came in waves and at different times, stimulated by over a period of a year, yes?
Certainly. One's memory, one's narrative gets really jumbled up. You know, there's three common reactions in the immediate aftermath of sexual assault. One is that you have an overt reaction, that you might be hysterical, you might be crying. I think that's the picture that we all think of when we think of sexual violence. But the following two are just as likely, if not more so. And it's one of controlled emotion, where someone feels as if they're just fine, that nothing happened at all. What are you talking about? I don't need help. I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And a third possibility is one of confusion and disbelief. And this is where you see a lot of disorientation,
yes,
a lot of interruptions of memory. You might remember parts of the assault at one time and then forget those and remember others. So there's a real disjointed experience frequently in the aftermath that can persist, certainly.
You know, one thing, and I appreciate that answer, but it just makes me, the one thing we can, we need to understand the memory, a confusion on part of anyone who goes through this kind of abuse, this kind of bullying, as is sexual violence. But what about the public's reaction to sexual violence in general? I mean, we have no excuse for memory loss. So what are we as a public, what do we need to learn as a community, as a nation, as a people? What do we do?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, sexual violence is very disturbing, isn't it? There's something,
yes,
about it that's more disturbing than many, many crimes. It's such a personal, it's an attack on mind, body, and spirit, using the most intimate parts of our body that we use to express, you know, sensuality, sexuality, and love. And to have that violated in such a way is, you know, I've heard more than one woman express that it is her worst fear.
Yes.
And I think for the public in general, you know, it's just really difficult to take into, to really take that fact in. You know, when I put out my rape memoir, for example, I had so many men friends tell me they just couldn't read it.
Mm.
And you know, I appreciate their honesty, because it's just so difficult to take in. It's disturbing on the one hand. And also, we don't want to believe that something like that can happen to us or that someone that we care about.
Yes.
And so it's a lot easier to keep it at arm's length. And this is also where victim blaming comes in, by the way. If it's something that the victim did wrong or didn't do, then we can say, oh, that would never happen to us because, you know, it's something that person did. So there's a lot of reasons that we try to keep it out of our consciousness. And the more imbalance there is in our society as a whole, as far as, you know, power goes, the more I think that we see the poverty rate growing and the more of an imbalance of resources that we have,
yes,
the more you're going to see crimes, sexual crimes, because it really is an expression of power and control, not an anger and not sex.
You know, I'm glad you say that. We can't hear it enough. It's not about the sex. It's about power and control over another human being. Where it comes from, I don't know. And of course, we need to learn about the attacker as well, so that we understand the sexual bully as well as the target. But I just think the denial of the world community, but certainly the American community, I my hat off to, even though They're taking a brunt now in the reaction because of in the aftermath of the Columbia University School of Journalism report on Rolling Stone. University of Virginia is getting a backlash because even the fraternity claims they're going to sue Rolling Stone, and who knows. But the point is, because Rolling Stone did not do their job, does not excuse the rest of us from doing ours. And the first thing is to stop denying that sexual violence is rampant. You know, bullying is epidemic in many of its forms, but certainly in sexual violence, usually, not in your case, I know you've told us, but usually from people we know, you know, a fellow student, a relative.
I was just going to say 2/3 of cases are perpetrated by someone known to the victim, 38% a so-called friend or acquaintance. You know, that's a much more difficult kind of crime to get to the bottom of, obviously. When it's a stranger rape, then all you have to do is prove that a sexual act happened and that you're strangers, and, you know, and it's pretty cut and dry. When it's somebody known, or, you know, somebody you've gone on a date with, or, you know, a friend, it becomes a he said, she said, and it's much more difficult to tease out. And it can be much more devastating, actually, for a victim under those circumstances as well. The betrayal is huge, is enormous.
You know, which reminds me, I think we should mention, regardless of all the reaction to the Rolling Stone article, the Charlottesville Police Chief Tim Longo, who's been on my show before, he's a wonderful guy, and of course, as we all remember, had to be the one to go through the entire Hannah Graham abduction and the discovery of her remains. And it was a difficult time for him and the city of Charlottesville, and all of us who try to be reasonable, thinking, balanced people. But Chief Longo stressed that he, although he could find no evidence to prove what was written in Rolling Stone about Jackie, he believes, first of all, the case is not closed as far as Chief Tim Longo is concerned, because he does believe that something traumatic happened to Jackie. And again, I keep coming back to Jackie because that isn't her real name, and at the same time, it represents all victims of sexual violence who do not have a voice, who don't come forward. What are some of the reasons? You know, because some people say to me, well, why wouldn't someone report a rape? Well, please, what are some of the reasons that that make it difficult, embarrassing, another whole rape, if you will, when you report being raped? Tell us about that.
That's so true. You know, incidentally, I had someone say to me, you know, the what happened after I reported was worse than the rape itself. That can happen, and that's unfortunate. We have, you know, theoretically, and often in practice, we do have measures in place to take better care of sexual assault victims than 20 years ago, say, even. But some reasons that people don't come forward are, one, fear of having their intimate lives exposed.
Yes.
And, you know, people often say, oh, victims want their 15 minutes of fame, so they're going to jump on the bandwagon and come forward if there's been other assaults reported. And actually, the opposite is true more frequently, that people are really terrified of having those details about their intimate lives exposed. Another reason people don't come forward is fear of not being believed.
Yes.
That used to be the number one reason. Now I think the number one reason is the fear of being exposed. Yes. That's what you'll hear, I think, most college students report, especially. It can also be re-traumatizing. That's another reason people don't come forward. To tell your story over and over again, like you have to do when you're seeking help or reporting, can be really overwhelming for some people. And I think more and more measures are in place to limit that, you know, to get the story told, you know, once or a few times and not over and over again. said, a lot of people fear that what happened to them wasn't serious enough to report. They think because they aren't, I don't know, severely injured physically, for example, that it's not a big deal. They question whether it's reportable.
Yes.
And the fact is that whether any other violence besides threat was used, even if a weapon wasn't used, and usually a weapon is not used, threat of force is most often the force used.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, on the FBI's list of violent crimes, rape ranks second only to murder.
Yes.
And sometimes it's first, because you can accidentally kill somebody, but you don't accidentally rape somebody.
Yeah, that's true. That reminds me, years ago, in New York, I dated a doctor who was an amazing physician in the emergency room and in the hospital in general. But I just know that a few dates were interrupted when she received a call that she had to report to the emergency room immediately. And watching her on the phone give directions how to prep everyone, et cetera, for whatever was needed. I was always so impressed. But one night we had a conversation about rape versus murder. And my position was that murder was worse. Well, the good doctor straightened me out, both as a medical physician and as a woman. And because she said, and I know you've said this too, and I'd like you to elaborate on it, because she said, murder is forever, yes, you're dead. But when you have been raped, the murder is repetitious. It continues. It's in replay for the rest of your life. How do you feel about that answer?
Well, it can be. That's what post-traumatic stress disorder is, is when the trauma gets stuck, mm-hmm. and is ever present. It is always now. That is what that trauma is. It's somehow there's an interruption in letting it become the past. And that's what the usefulness of different kinds of therapy,
yes.
Can be, is to help move the trauma from the ever-present to the past.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, I would say healing is very possible, and that's one of my messages. Is that it is possible to heal and to put that trauma in the past. You won't forget it, and it will shape you, but it doesn't have to define you forevermore. It can be a memory you have, just like, your a lonely childhood or a sad movie you saw. It will be there, but it doesn't have to be your everything. So in that way, it doesn't need to be forever. It will hurt you forever. It doesn't mm-hmm. need to hurt you forever. The sad news is that it's a choice that you have to make, mm-hmm. as in my experience, on all sides of the couch in the therapy room,
yes.
is that the choice you have to make to recover. It's not fair that you're left with having to make that decision, having been violated, that you have to, get yourself together and make this decision to make this fight to get well. But it is a decision you can make, and it is a process you can go through and heal.
Yes.
And on the other side of that, the gifts of overcoming trauma like that are a greater capacity for empathy,
mm-hmm.
for example, more understanding,
yes.
A greater perspective. So there can be gifts to adversity as well.
All right, we're going to take a break after that. Thank you so much, Ashley Warner, for that and all your answers. And The Year After, which is a memoir of a rape, but it is also about the healing process, as Ashley was just describing to us. It is a choice that is forced on us, but it is a choice that that when taken for the positive of moving forward, as Ashley Warner obviously has done, it's a choice that gives great rewards to the person involved, but to everyone with whom they speak. I know I have faith every time I have a conversation with Ashley. I believe, this does have a positive outcome if all of us begin to be a part of the solution. We're going to take a break. Stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back with author Ashley Warner, The Year After.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. There are some fine films centered around the concept of city mouse, country mouse. Junebug is one of the best. It takes an observant writer and some very fine filmmaking to tell a story of culture shock that maintains empathy for both city and country folk and doesn't resort to cliche and cheap laughs. Laughter here is character-driven and non-judgmental, a difficult balance struck by writer Angus McLaughlin and director Phil Morrison. When Madeline, a Chicago art gallery owner, married George, a North Carolina boy, he didn't bother to invite his relatives to the ceremony. He put country and his family behind him. The twist comes when gallery business brings the newlyweds back to his hometown. This is a story about people striving for a different life, about those who are satisfied with the lives they are leading, and about those who are just plain stuck. The sweet essence that makes this film a special gem comes from Ashley, George's pregnant sister-in-law, a high school bride married to a deeply dissatisfied husband. Ashley tries mightily to make her world a happy one, steadfastly refusing to acknowledge her own misery. She is beautifully played by Amy Adams in this extraordinary breakthrough role. A star was born in Junebug. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. My guest is Ashley Warner, the author of The Year After. It is a rape memoir that is primarily about the healing process. And Ashley, why don't we start out explaining exactly what kind of therapist you are and who is predominantly the patients who come to you?
I'm a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and psychoanalyst. I'm trained in a particular style that really values an empathic approach. So my style is to really want to get into what somebody else's experiences and understand from there. And so with that, I work with a variety of people. I do have a specialty with working with survivors of trauma, including sexual violence and loss and transitions. And, you know, it's a really successful approach, I think, for working with trauma, because I think when you have been victimized, and especially with sexual trauma, you've been voiceless.
Yes.
You've really had your, you know, your volition taken away from you. So it's a really, I think, important part of the healing process to be heard and understood fully and have a chance to express yourself fully and have that respected.
Yes. And you, we'll mention this again before we end the show, but you travel and speak not only about your book, obviously, but also to this, your theories, your approach to therapy, to the healing process of trauma of all kinds. Can you tell us how one can get a hold of you if they want you to come speak at their university or college or...
talk to colleges and universities a lot, and what I do most is use my book as a launching point for talking about different aspects of sexual violence. So it's really become a tool to help start a conversation. And you can reach me at ashleywarner.com. You can find out more about me, my therapy practice, as well as my how to hire me for a speaking engagement.
Very good. Now, back to the reasons, because I know there are more than a few. The reasons it seems it is difficult for those who have been the target of sexual violence, domestic abuse, bullying in its forms. Again, it's a thing of someone imposing their power over you, not because you did anything. It's also, I mean, the reports all about the bullying in particular that even NFL guys are bullied, and they're certainly not some weakling little thing, or it's not what they wear or their size. It's that it's the whatever's driving that need to prove one is better or stronger by physically traumatizing another human being. Maybe that's it. But why, in addition to the obvious, hey, why would I want to say this over and over and over again and expose myself to public ridicule? Perhaps an extreme example is what Jackie is going through, even though somewhat anonymously. But what other reasons? And I guess we should touch on the rape kit and where that fits in and the necessity for it as well. You tell us.
Right. Well, we were talking a lot about some of the reasons. One we haven't talked about yet is the fear of retaliation.
Yes.
And that, I think, is especially strong when it's someone known to the victim, when the perpetrator is someone known. You're often in similar social circles, if not the same social circle, or you go to the same school, or, and if it's a he said, she said, you can't be sure that everybody's going to be on your side. That can be really discouraging, feeling like you have the strength to come forward, and that there isn't going to be only, there's a fear of retaliation potentially not only from the perpetrator, but from other people in your community or his or hers.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the rapist is a male. So there can be fear of many levels of retaliation. Also, you were talking about wanting to get into how important it is, I think, to report, even though there's all of these understandable barriers for a woman to, or any survivor to come forward and report. There are tremendous advantages to doing so. And I think you wanted to get into that. And
yes.
One is because you're, it really, when you get the support that you need, when you report, and it's great to go to a rape crisis center and get a victim advocate if one is available in your area.
Mm-hmm.
Supportive, sensitive care in the immediate aftermath really mitigates problems like post-traumatic stress disorder or other symptoms. It can really speed healing as well as be a wonderful way to receive resources if you decide to report, if you decide to pursue therapy. And a rape kit is something that I encourage all survivors to get. You can get one up to 96 hours after. It can still be effective. And it's not pleasant. They're going to be taking, swabs from your cervix to make sure that they can pick up any DNA evidence that might be there. It's not a comfortable exam to have, but it can be instrumental if you do decide to report. You don't have to report. If you get an exam, it doesn't mean you are obligated to report, but it opens your options up.
Yes.
And in my case, it was instrumental to getting a conviction. There was DNA evidence that, served to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that my perpetrator was guilty.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned if it's someone you know and it's a friend of the family or whatever, or a fellow student. But I wonder also, and I'm not in the habit, nor am I accusing, because I have no way of knowing without a court of law and the jury of his peers. I don't know what this full story is with Bill Cosby. In my show business career, our paths have crossed a couple of times. I can't say I know him. I've just met him. But when it is a celebrity, is there a greater concern about coming out and speaking up? I mean, and there's, well, what? Let me let you answer that.
Well, I think that the reasons we've touched on are exacerbated when it's a celebrity. It's a lot more, there are protections in a court of law against having your intimate details of your personal life exposed as a victim, but there are no such protections in the court of public opinion.
Exactly.
So if you're making an accusation against a celebrity, you are likely going to be in the spotlight in a way that is maybe very uncomfortable and very difficult. And I think that in is one of many reasons that it might take someone a long time to come forward, because in the immediate aftermath and the crisis of it, it can be more difficult and overwhelming than after some time has passed. And if there's others that you can be supported by, you know, you have more of a collective voice. But, you know, we love and need our celebrities. And I just want to also say that, you know, we aren't accusing anyone here. There
exactly.
is no court of law. But celebrities, we love our celebrities, and we need our celebrities, and they serve a function for us collectively of someone we can idealize and kind of picture being like, or, they uplift us. And so whether it's a local celebrity or a local sports celebrity or local other kind of celebrity or a national celebrity,
yes.
We're very reluctant to give those up. And it's kind of damaging on a cultural level, too, to have their reputation damaged. And I think there's a resistance to believing that someone could be commit a crime
sure.
that we adore so much. Yeah,
exactly.
We don't know if these people are guilty or innocent, but we are reluctant to even trying on that idea.
And you know, I think also, as you say, the part of that and a large part of the reason of my bringing up specifically Bill Cosby is that I know his attorney, Martin Singer, his point, why would someone who had something like this happen to them wait so long to report it? And I think, I know we've talked about that already, but I'd like, if you wouldn't mind reiterating that, because there are sound reasons, and maybe we've said enough about it, you let me know, but obviously when this, I know how, let's talk about it. I believe you told me in one interview that your book is called The Year After because it took you that long to be able to talk about it. So maybe you can answer Martin Singer's question. Why would a woman wait so long if something like this happened to her?
Well, to address the first part you were bringing up about my experience and my book The Year After, you know, a year is a good rule of thumb for going through the firsts, you know, the first holidays, the seasons for the first time. And by the time you've reached the year anniversary, you hopefully are the experience is becoming a little more integrated in your day to day, and the crisis is over, the extreme feelings might be over. So that's certainly one reason I think it might take long to come forward, because again, when you're out of the crisis mode and aren't so reactionary all of the time,
mm-hmm.
you can be a little more forward-looking and care a little bit more, too, about other people out there.
Yes.
It's a very, very, at least in my experience and in the experience of being a therapist and working with survivors, it's necessarily very self-absorbed time, and it should be.
Yeah.
And the attention is on yourself and needs to be, and you need to heal. After that, you can kind of look around and say, there's other people out there. Maybe I could help. Maybe
yes.
I want to become part of a cause. Maybe I have something to contribute. So as far as the women taking so long to come forward with Cosby, I think that they feared not being believed, and there was evidence that they were not. The people that did come forward sooner than later were not believed.
Mm-hmm.
Once it gained a critical mass, I think you have more people coming forward because they felt that they would have, they had support, that there would be people there who would believe them and back them up, and there was comfort in that community. And I think that the women didn't come forward, too, because of fear of retaliation. A lot of these women's careers were at stake, and they worried that if they came forward against somebody powerful in their community, that it might interfere with their work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a lot of the reasons that we talked about why women don't report are the same as why the Cosby accusers took so long, too. It's just exaggerated exponentially.
Yes. Let's speak.
Fame and power.
Let's speak to, speaking of the power play, if you will. This is not, rape is not simply an issue of violence against individuals. I mean, obviously we have been saying that it's traumatic, it's violent, it's a powerfully intimidating, but it's also a humanitarian issue. And I wish we could, maybe that's a way to get the public to stop denying it. In the same way they should stop denying climate change. I mean, weather is changing, bullying and rape are epidemic. Maybe we need somehow to turn this into, well, it is, we don't have to turn it into, but recognize it is man's inhumanity to fellow human beings. It is an humanitarian issue. How can we define it in those terms for the public?
More frequently, to answer this good question that you ask. I think sexual violence has been for so long a concern of women's rights activists, and men haven't been a part of the conversation enough. And it really is a humanitarian issue, as you say. It is not a women's issue. When we lose women because they are recovering from sexual trauma and aren't able to participate fully in our communities and our economies, then we all lose.
Yes.
We lose the contribution that society gives. And by the way, as we've mentioned with our talk today, men are also victims of,
yes,
of violence, but women, at least the evidence, research shows at this point, to much more of a bigger degree right now. 9 out of 10 rapes are sexual assaults are women. So we lose that, and we need men to be thought of not as potential rapists, but we need men to be in on this conversation.
Yes.
Because most men are not rapists.
Exactly.
And they're part of our solution. So I think these are conversations we need to have, and it's complicated. And the sexual violence that the campuses in particular are struggling to work with are not easy. You know, it's insidious. Sometimes it's an overt case of violence. A lot of times there's a lot of head games involved. Like, I want to give you an example of, I've heard this several times by people I work with.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one example. A young woman comes into my office that I'm working with and reports that she had been talking to somebody on social media or met somebody at a dating website.
Uh-huh.
And didn't know them. I don't know if she'd met him yet or not. It doesn't matter. But she goes out one night for a few drinks and, thinks, oh, let me call this person I just have been talking to. They're in the neighborhood and invites him along, and he comes and plies her with more drinks, or she drinks more drinks of her own volition, whatever. But on the way home, instead of putting her in a cab, he's like, no, come to my place. And she's like, oh, I don't really want to. Oh, come to my place. Oh, I don't really want to. But they go to his place. They have sex, even though she's like, no, I don't really want to. I don't really want to. So the question is, was she raped?
Yes.
Like, that's what we're dealing with.
Uh-huh.
I brought this example up at a recent talk, and, the students I was addressing, they were all across the map. Some people think,
yes,
she was, some people think she wasn't. I have an opinion. I don't have the definitive answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if we, that this, this would never be convicted, this would never be a reportable sexual violence event.
Uh-huh.
Technically, she said no, but she was really wishy-washy. But I had a hunch that if we pulled the thread, if for some reason you were able to look at this man's history, I bet there are many, many, many examples,
mm-hmm,
of him convincing, kind of manipulating women to have sex with him.
Yes.
I think he knew what he was doing.
And that goes right to the point I've often, when I've talked with people who are involved in the healing process of of bullying again in any form, sexual or otherwise, that defining even to the attacker, the one who perpetuates the violent traumatic act, whether it's rape or beating a wife or whatever it is, the attacker themselves are not clear on what bullying or what rape is. I listen sometimes, and you know, I'm going to do a series of radio interviews, and if you can think of any men that will be willing to be guests, please let me know, because I agree with you. I think this is past time for men to be a part of this conversation, because I think you've hit on something, at least for me. Men don't, even the men who are the 90% that don't rape women, I don't know that they can clearly define what rape is. It's easy to say, okay, she's fighting the guy off, she's saying no, she's resisting physically, okay, that's rape. But what if something like you've just described as an example? I think we need to have that conversation, and I think it's a conversation men need to have. Anyway, I appreciate your giving that example, because that's taken me off into a whole nother place to investigate this and have people on the show to discuss it. We have used up all our time, but yeah. Ashley, as always, you've been incredibly informative and helpful, and I mean that. Any guests, male or female, but particularly men, if you think of that we need to have on the show on this subject, I think it's time to do more of that. I agree with you. Before we go and say goodbye to Ashley Warner, I'd like her again to let us know how we can get her book The Year After and how we can engage her as a speaker for our clubs and organizations and universities, etc. Ashley?
Yes, please find my book The Year After, a memoir, at your favorite online retailer, and you can reach me at ashleywarner.com.
Thank you so much, Ashley, for being on the show again. I'd like to say I hope we never have to have this conversation again, but I'm sure we will, and I will also talk with anyone you suggest. This is a humanitarian issue. Any woman who is raped is somebody's daughter, maybe somebody's wife, fiance, girlfriend, sister, grandmother. It is a humanitarian issue, and it needs men talking about it as well as women. And again, I can't thank you enough, Ashley.
Thank you, Marcello. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. You take care. Bye now.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. It takes an unusual film to have us laughing out loud and horrified at the same time. This is the case with the 2009 documentary, The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia. The Whites are a contemporary lawless clan that knows how to party no matter what the consequence. Don't get in their way. Crossing them could lead to a bad end. They speak of stabbing errant husbands and shooting no good uncles with particular delight. One can only guess what might happen to an outsider who displeases them. This is a thoroughly balanced look at a tough family to watch. The music and dancing are wonderful, the history of the clan as it evolves from the corrupt practices of corporate coal cartels is riveting, and the terrifying lawlessness is a legacy which will clearly continue. The younger offspring delight in demonic behavior as their parents drink, drug, and party their lives away. A lot of credit goes to director Julian Nitzberg, who spent a full dangerous year filming the colorful outlaw clan in their mountain home. Through his film, we get the opportunity to observe a fascinating piece of Americana, the wild and wonderful whites of West Virginia. Real? Oh my. Horrific? Yes. Entertaining? Absolutely. Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. First, carpe diem, but then seize the year. Like most people, when one year evolves into another, I'm reminded of all those full of promise for our future and those now relegated to our history. I miss all those who left us in 2014 and one who stayed just long enough to share his son's achievement and remind us all to go liberally into 2015. I especially miss those still here, but only on camera, and those activists only death could deactivate, whose lives are our education of how to advocate for each other. I miss Mom and Dad, as I do my grandmama and Uncle Gino, who crossed the bar long before. I miss how they could educate with such magnitude in a single phrase. No adjectives or adverbs needed for this quintet. Except Mom, of course, and later her protege, me. For my family, it was out with the old and in with the new, while others were complaining, why should I have to push one for English? I know, no matter what they say, letting go is scary, especially for conservative hearts and minds, but like indicting war criminals, it may prove to be our only hope to succeed at breathing healing life into our conflicted America. I miss all those gone much too soon because a toy gun was just too enticing and a real one too handy. With a faith to dream, arms spread to embrace, minds open to the truth, and our mind's eye focused on the horizon, where barely visible stands the glory of justice for all, waiting, just waiting for us to grasp it as our weapon of choice. What of past promises for a day, a life, a planet, where new ideas, even thinking for ourselves, is restored? For that dream come true, peace and hope need be liberally spread to evolve our nation. Until then, the lies we tell ourselves will keep us in denial, like seeing homes buried in feet of snow as disproving climate change, or watching towns and lives tornado-twisted, thinking global warming is a hoax. Then there's antagonistic partnering of corporatism and those in government using militarized law enforcement to protect cash flow status quo, believing there is no need to fix a society that cannot embrace American diversities as enlightening universities. And finally, denying our nation the natural benefits of immense historic contribution from hyphenated citizens we continue to deem second class in nature, like women, African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, Italian Americans. We descendants of immigrants, forgetting most of our ancestors, chose America to make a difference, as did Native Americans before us, and African Americans, after emancipation, freed them to do so. Listen, I love our country, and I cherish our United States Constitution, particularly when we don't practice what it preaches. But abusing it for profit reaches the darkest depths of hypocrisy, and manipulating the Bill of Rights for political gain, the very underbelly of the Patriot Act. Listen, our National and Coast Guards are our 21st century well-regulated militia minutemen, and not Tea Party extremists sanctioning an open-carry wannabe police state. On the rise, we have flu and corporate greed infecting politicians with corruption. Yet, we elect those who think the poor and less fortunate should be exterminated. On the other hand, American Ebola, gas prices, and our morale are down. Yet we vote for Wall Street's keystone bottom line rather than love thy neighbor as thyself. The truth is, America is not too big to fail if we continue to accept top-heavy, too-big-to-jail reconstruction of capitalism. Our future can only stand its ground when the responsibilities of freedom, liberty, justice, and paying taxes are supported equally by all pillars of society's foundation. Now, at last, in harmonious declaration, can we not in Thanksgiving celebrate the memories of lives that still impact America? Like Governor Mario Cuomo, gun control advocate James Brady, Progressive Democrat of America founder Tim Carpenter, If I Had a Hammer Pete Seeger, Watergate and Washington Post Ben Bradley, master poet and master human being Maya Angelou, peacetime hero veteran Louis Zamperini, immigrant Mike Nichols, fashionable Oscar De La Renta, Robin Williams, and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Elaine Stritch and Lauren Bacall, Mickey Rooney and Eli Wallach, Ruby Dee and Shirley Temple, Harold Ramis and Bob Hoskins, James Garner, Ann B. Davis, James Rebhorn, and Edward Herman, comedians Sid Caesar and Joan Rivers, Eileen Ford, and singers Joe Cocker and Jerry Vale, boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter, Rafael Ramos, Wenjian Liu, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and Tamir Rice. I will go. I shall go to see what our new beginning will be. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.